Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Orville Schell, who was formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, and currently is the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. His books include Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of China's Leaders, Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La, From the Himalayas to Hollywood. And his latest book, co-authored with John Delurie, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Orville Schell.
Pleasure to be with you.
And I've spoken over the years to a number of China experts and people that have served there in the State Department and other government agencies. And there's a disconnect often between a lot of the popular writing about China and the more scholarly writing about China, in as much as there's this expectation that China will take over the world. But a lot of people who know China better say, no, the Chinese leaders are always looking over their shoulders. So given what's happening to the China's economy, where the growth rate is slowing, what's your sense, and many people like Paul Krugman and others are suggesting that China's economy may even crash, what picture can you give us of the contemporary political situation and economic situation?
Well, I think the first thing to note is that the last 2.5 decades have been a period of rather extraordinary economic growth. In fact, I think nowhere in world history do we see anything even approaching what the Chinese have managed to accomplish. There are tremendous structural weaknesses in its economy. You know, the disparity between the degree of political reform and economic reform. You have this old Leninist, Stalinist structure of a government and a communist party trying to preside over all of this entrepreneurial energy and developmental energy. So where it is going is hard to say. But I think one has to acknowledge that to date, at least, it's done a pretty extraordinary job in riding out some of the bumps which have laid low America and Western Europe. But, you know, one does have a sense, being in China now, that they've come to the end of something, that from here on, it's going to be more and more difficult to keep the economy going at a rapid enough rate with just tweaking, that there may need to be some new structural reforms that require some very bold leadership. And whether China is up to that, and whether its leadership, which is now much more sort of consensual in its nature, and what I mean by that is that they need to sort of argue things out. No big leader can just make his decision and have it carried out. That's another question.
But if this transition from with a declining growth rate, and of course it's been pretty extraordinary up until now, and the idea of changing the economy, recalibrating the economy to stimulate consumption, the government's going to have to recalibrate growth so that average household incomes can rise and consumers have more money to spend. And my understanding that in a curious and paradoxical way, the Chinese consumers are very skeptical of their own country's products because of scandals. And look, and if mothers in China can't trust the baby formula they feed their children with, they have some serious problems.
Well, you've pointed out a number of sort of interesting challenges for China. The first is that they have succeeded in enjoying this period of economic dynamism to date, largely by exporting, and exporting all around the world. The United States has been buying a tremendous amount of stuff, as has Europe and other areas. They've got to switch over from an export economy to an economy which sort of sustains itself by more Chinese consumption. And about this, almost every economist agrees. And I would have to say it is a challenge. However, anyone who's been to China lately will see that there is a kind of an ingrowing disposition to buy and consume. And there is a growing untapped market as more and more people move into the middle class. But nonetheless, What impedes China from sort of having its own engine of growth and not exporting is that its welfare system, its healthcare system, is very, very incomplete. So people tend to save a lot. So as long as they have this very high rate of savings, exactly the opposite of the U.S., they're not going to be consuming. And if they're not consuming, they're not going to be keeping their growth rate going, sort of this internal engine of growth. And that is the dilemma that they now face.
But the element of corruption, which is involved in these shoddy products and sometimes dangerous products, and if the Chinese mothers are desperately trying to get baby formula on the global market, and you've got the Bo Xilai case coming up in this month of August, give us a sense of how ingrained corruption is. Because my understanding is that the Communist Party elite have a combined wealth of I think something like $100 billion, compared to, if you aggregate the wealth of the U.S. Congress and the Supreme Court, it's about $7 to $8 billion. So there's already, and apparently about $200 billion has been stashed offshore with the princelings and the offspring of the elite. So how deep is this problem of both corruption in terms of economic products, consumer products, and the lack of oversight, and then the overall corruption, which may come to light in the Bo Xilai trial?
Well, again, there's a lot to unpack here. You know, in our book, which is entitled Wealth and Power, one would have to say that it's been these two Chinese characters, which China has been pursuing these years rather recklessly, but rather successfully. Why? Because they want their country once again to be wealthy, powerful, of consequence, and respected. But in the process of attaining these goals, after having slid from a very high state of superiority in the world as they knew it back in the dynastic period, they have been quite, as I said, quite reckless. And the results have been severe environmental degradation, which has meant that there's a tremendous food safety issue, and people are very concerned, particularly in regards to their children. It means also that there's been a lot of corruption because this growth has been sort of so helter-skelter and been presided over by a one-party system and an old sort of Leninist state that is really not up to the task. Moreover, it's been a circumstance in which all the property is owned by the state and all the banks are owned by the state. A fatal combination when it comes to corruption, because it means government bureaucrats are presiding over these massive development transactions, land transactions, shopping malls, and, you know, highways, and this, that, and the other. And there's ample chances for rake-offs, ergo this very severe corruption problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Orville Schell, who is formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, and currently is the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. And his latest book, co-authored with John Delurie, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. And the book does cover a long sweep of history of China's transformation from humiliation to glory, although, as our conversation indicates, it's not a complete picture and it's not entirely successful at this point, but it has been pretty extraordinary, the change. But what I see in your new book, Orville Schell, is that so many of the characters who have shaped China's history have been courageous intellectuals and thinkers, and I'm trying to get a sense of where Mao fits into that, given how much the Marxist-Leninism has changed the country, but in a rather brutal way, and its successor, authoritarian capitalism that they have now, is a kind of paradox. But I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, you've got these characters like the artist Ai Weiwei, who are trying to push the envelope. And they seem to me to be very much in line with all of the people that you profiled in your book throughout China's history. But I'm trying to get a sense of where Mao fits into that lexicon in terms of...
Well, I think it's fair to say that the Chinese Communist Revolution, as led by Mao, was in its cryptic way also part of this long effort to rejuvenate China. In other words, to make China change it from being the so-called sick man of Asia to being a country that couldn't be bullied, pushed around, that people had to listen to. Mao was sort of the bad boy on the block, and he got a certain grudging respect by acting up and being somewhat unpredictable. One of the curious things that he did do was that during the 20th century, I think one of the impediments to China regaining wealth, power, status, respect, always seemed to be its own traditional Confucian culture, which revolutionaries, reformers, intellectuals, by and large, saw as suffocating, stolid, paralyzing, and preventing China from being able to innovate, move forward, and thus be able to defend itself against the predations of the great powers in the West, and particularly Japan. But Mao, through his draconian, savage, and brutal revolution, particularly the Cultural Revolution, did finally put an end to that culture. So when Deng Xiaoping came along with his pragmatism and his, you know, get rich is glorious theme, the landscape was sort of clear for him to undertake this next great stage of it was really counter-revolution, if you use Mao as the yardstick. So Mao played a critical role in many ways, tremendously destructive. But I think one can make the case that it was kind of a form of creative destruction if you look at the 20th century as an effort by China to escape its past and the confines of its own old, rather limiting cultural tradition.
Well, I suppose, though, in a way, the paradox that I'm trying to wrestle with is the notion that so many of the characters throughout China's history that you've profiled in your new book, Orville Schell, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, are those, of course, that tried to break out from the shackles of Western colonial exploitation. And then you've got the contemporary heroes, if you will, you know, Zhao Zheng, Hu Yobao, who was the inspiration for the students to get into Tiananmen, and the dissident Liu Xiaobo that you have also profiled in the book. They seem to be pushing, and I mentioned the artist Ai Weiwei, they're pushing against the communist government that's been in for some time. And I guess we're in the West sort of fascinated by these reformers, and we saw Tiananmen, and since then it seems that the Communist Party have effectively substituted democratic aspirations for a form of kind of capitalist nationalism, if you will. So give me a sense of how, because my understanding is that the internet is exploding there, that people are getting their news now from others.
Well, maybe deal with the question of this other.
Sure, I'm sorry.
Thinking.
Right.
You're absolutely right. There is a tradition represented by people like Liu Xiaobo, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, who's presently in jail. You know, Ai Weiwei. There are many others. Wei Jingsheng, Fang Lijie, for those who know Chinese history. However, the primary sort of motivation, I think, during the last century for most Chinese, not all, was to make China unified, whole again, capable of defending itself. And to do that, it needed to gain a certain modicum of wealth and power. These other democratic thinkers who were more in the tradition of sort of the Enlightenment and Western thinking that believe that people just have rights that they should be able to enjoy, that democracy isn't just a utilitarian tool that you use to get wealthy and powerful. These people were something of a sideshow. But presently, we come to kind of, as I suggested earlier, a possible next chapter. Having attained unification and a certain amount of wealth and power, the next question is raised is, what's the next chapter for Chinese history? And here, I think, is where this tradition of greater sort of democratic form of governance will raise its head. Now China is actually ready with a larger middle class, with not such widespread poverty, and close to great nation status. So this is why the next period is going to be so interesting. is to see how they write the script for this next act. They can't just go along the way they have. I think they're going to run out of rope on this sort of Leninist capitalist phase, and they're going to have to start to look at political reform of what is this country really all about? What is its relationship going to be between the government and the governed?
And I guess the only yardsticks we have in that regard, I suppose, are the historical examples of what happened to the Soviet Union. And it's an interesting paradox that Gorbachev showed up at the time at Tiananmen. And it's clear that the Chinese leadership learned from the Russian experience of the collapse of communism, in the sense that Gorbachev instituted glasnost as a way to stimulate economic reform, perestroika. But
and the Communist Party fears this very much.
Right.
They look at the Russian example, and they look at Gorbachev as sort of a non-example, exactly what they do not want to see happen to China. So the question is, are they going to be able to make a peaceful sort of evolutionary transition from what they have now, which is a considerable new middle class and a considerable amount of wealth and more global power, to some form of government that will sustain them over the long run. We have no example of this having ever happened before, a Marxist-Leninist state, in effect, sort of putting itself out of business or modulating itself in a way that allows for it to kind of continue on over the long run. Will China succeed? You know, I've been surprised again and again and again by China. I wouldn't write it off, but it is a daunting prospect.
But the notion that this transition would, as a lot of, I imagine, the Chinese communist leadership, I'm trying to figure out whether how much they're involved in holding on to their privilege or and using this portent of chaos as an excuse. Because why is it that if you give people more freedom and democracy, which they're getting at any rate incrementally, why does that automatically translate into chaos? And
well, the Chinese experience has been that when a powerful centralized leader, and in this every leader in China, from Sun Yat-sen to Chiang Kai-shek to Mao Zedong, Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, they all agree. Strong central leadership, don't let power devolve too rapidly downward, because you will have chaos and confusion. Sun Yat-sen had this phrase. He described China as a dish of loose sand, and what he thought the country needed was some sort of binding agent, some cement to kind of bring it all together. So there's a natural sort of ingrown autonomic predisposition to fear chaos and disunity, and that's why this is proving such a challenge for the present government to know how to relax a little. And that sometimes the best way to avoid chaos and instability is to yield. But this, they're not very good at this. And the Gorbachev model, they say, look what happened to Gorbachev. He's on the ash heap of history. The Soviet Union is disunified, broke apart, and this is not what we want to see happen in China.
But they have, in spite of the authoritarian and centralized nature of this government, they have at least moved in the direction of having a kind of parallel government to the Communist Party. And my understanding is that a lot of the Chinese people recognize the party as being these corrupt officials, that apparently every day there are hundreds of demonstrations about confiscation of land and other outrages where these local party leaders are responsible. So it seems to me that you have a choice between an embryonic form of government that's already in rule of law and other things they've tried to create in spite of the party. And then you've got the party, which is, I think, rapidly becoming discredited, isn't it? So it would seem that history is on the side of what is being born as opposed to what is dying.
Well, that's a very Western notion of history.
Right. That, I'm sorry about that, yeah.
You know, that societies inevitably sort of evolve, you know, ineluctably towards greater openness and more democratic forms of governance. It's very American. It's very sort of post, you know, or French Revolution. We don't quite know how China's going to end, but we do know that China is not Europe. and China is not America. And whatever course they take will not be one, I think, which is immediately recognizable to us. And their trajectory so far has not been anything that's been predictable or particularly recognizable. I do think, however, that everything keeps changing. Even Marx knew this, Mao knew this, everybody knows this, and you've got to keep evolving. So the question is, in a country that doesn't have a strong sort of foundational set of documents or a strong sense of what it wants to be, what's the guide and where is it going to go? We know it's going to go someplace. We just don't know where. I wager it's going to have to open up more. It's going to have to win the respect of its people by respecting them in ways which we could describe as democratic or consultatory or something. But, you know, if you look over the last 25 years, you wouldn't have thought they would have gotten as far as they did, but they did. So going forward, we don't have a lot of experience with this strange model that they have confected, and it is a strangely compassless ocean on which they find themselves sailing.
Well, I appreciate you joining us here today, Orville, and I was packing so much into these questions because we have so little time and there's so much more to talk about, and I appreciate the depth and scope of your new book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Orville Schell, who was formerly the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley and currently is the Arthur Ross Director of the Asia Society Center on U.S.-China Relations. His books include Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square and The Next Generation of China's Leaders, Virtual Tibet, Searching for Shangri-La from the Himalayas to Hollywood, and his latest book, co-authored with John DeLury, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.